From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. Every industry, art, science, music, sports, is filled with partnerships and rivalries. And in his new book, Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs, Joshua Wolf-Schenk explores the need for collaboration and the fluidity of flexibility that partners provide. We'll talk about his book with him, as well as an article he did in The Atlantic about positive psychology, and I'll pair up with him next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Alpha and beta, symbiosis, team power, those working as pairs often produce more creatively and innovatively. That's the argument in Joshua Wolf-Schenk's latest book. Think Freud and Jung, Lennon and McCartney, George Balanchine and Suzanne Farrell, or Orville and Wilbur, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. In The Power of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs, Joshua Wolf-Schenk takes on what he sees as the lone genius myth and makes the case for creativity depending on connections between two people. He's also the author of a book on Lincoln called Lincoln's Melancholy and has published works in a number of magazines. He's been a contributor at Atlantic, Harper's, The New Yorker, and other publications, and joins us in the second hour forum. And welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. I want to talk about this whole notion that two can do better or two can be more creative. First, I thought my listeners would be interested in hearing a bit of what you have to say about another article of yours, which got a lot of attention that came out before this book came out. It was an article in The Atlantic on this comprehensive longitudinal study, the longest in history, under George Valiant, a psychiatrist, about 268 men, Harvard study, famous study, 1938, followed all these males from their sophomore year right on to what they had made out of their lives or what lives had made out of them. And this was the kind of Brokaw greatest generation. About 80% of these men fought in World War II. And we get a sense of the different passages that they go through. Now, it's all men, and that's one problem. But we learned a lot about the nature of happiness, supposedly, from this, or at least what makes people happy. And I wanted at least to get you on record as to what that is.
Yes. Well, all my work proceeds from some big question, and the question of this study is the biggest of them all, and that's what makes a good life. And the material of having followed these men extremely closely, beginning when they were teenagers all the way through to their 80s and 90s for the men who are still living at the time, and a number of men are still living, is about as dense and a comprehensive a body of material as you can imagine on that question. And the basic conclusion of the study is that everyone has troubles, and these are men for whom who are the least troubled, the candidates for the least trouble in human history in terms of their socioeconomic status and all manner of privilege, and yet all of them did meet trouble, and the question becomes, how do they respond to it?
Even though they were kept anonymous and there was confidentiality, we know now that JFK was one.
That's right.
That Ben Bradley was one.
That's right. Yeah, Ben Bradley came out, so to speak, quite a while ago. JFK, I confirmed his involvement in my research. But they're mostly anonymous.
So one of the things we learned about happiness was and it's been confirmed in a Columbia study recently that people are happiest or experience the most joy when they experience something that's unexpected or unanticipated, and it's good. You know, it's triumphant or it's pleasurable or it's a success or things along those lines. But we also learned what at least Freud told us, work and love are very important, but so are many other things.
Yes. Well, George Valiant, who was the director of the study starting in the 60s and is still very carefully involved tracking these men, who is himself in his autumn years, primarily is interested in this idea of adaptation. And the study becomes a way of illuminating this idea that we are who we are by the way we respond to trouble, and whether it's conscious or unconscious. And he has found in these men illustrations of the most sublime adaptive adaptations, humor, altruism, these things we do in response to trouble that make us better and more useful, all the way down to the things we do that are least useful, which is his way of thinking about what mental illness is.
So it's adaptation, it's also work and love, it's education, it's also stable marriage and not smoking and not drinking.
Yeah, they're also
all tied into.
Well, they're all kinds of small little nuggets that you take away from the study and all kinds of vivid details and great characters. I mean, it's my interest in the study is a lot about it, the intersection of science, where we want very concrete answers, and literature, because it's very much you know, these epic stories. George compares the files, which are the size of a big phone book, to a Russian novel.
This whole article can be actually, you can get access to it online. It's in The Atlantic. It's by our guest this hour, Joshua Wolff-Shank. But Josh wants to talk with us about pairs and how they work and duality and dyads and all that sort of thing. And so let's go there now. And,
sure.
We'll certainly hear from listeners about this kind of symbiotic process. It is a kind of chemistry that you believe exists between people. It's a, you call it a creative intimacy and synergy, but a lot of it has to do with rivalry, competition.
Well, there are all kinds of ways that it manifests. I mean, the question is, this thing we call chemistry or synergy, this quality between two people that buoys them up, what is that and how do we grapple with it? As I got into that question, I saw this is not an incidental thing. This is not some far-off question about exceptional people like Lennon and McCartney, although I do get into them in great depth. This is a universal experience, and it shows up in many manifestations and variations. And when we get down to it, we see that we're never really creating alone. And even these great vaunted stories of lone geniuses like Vincent van Gogh, for example, or even Emily Dickinson, there's always some relationship operating behind the scenes.
Well, I wondered about that. I mean, you know, we all have been sort of taken into this idea of the lone genius, and we've almost been inculcated into believing it. But I think about, you know, who came immediately to mind was Faulkner. I don't know. Now, every writer has his editor, and you write about your relationship with your editor, and that's a kind of creative process between two people. But Faulkner was someone who created pretty much alone for the most part and by himself, even though he was helped early on by Sherwood Anderson. He was a kind of lone genius, really.
Well, the pair is a really important unit for creativity, in part because it helps us understand that solitude and community are not at odds with each other. Solitude is part of being in relationships. And relationships, when they work, a lot of what they do is help us be in solitude in a proper way. And that opposition is really something we've been – it's a false opposition, and it's one we've been grinding on for quite a long time, that either it's the individual or the sort of vast network. And when you look at it, the relationship really allows us to hold both things at once. It's funny you mentioned Faulkner, because I've had this experience over and over again over the last 5 years, my jaw dropping at these revelations that were a total shock to me. It was a shock to me to learn that Vincent van Gogh was in a proper partnership with his brother. He was more than
just
a supporter.
His brother Theo and he were it was a partnership.
And they regarded themselves as the co-creators of the work that bore Vincent's name. It was a shock to me to know that Einstein worked out the theory of relativity in conversation with a fellow who's hardly known to history. And these shocks continue. Someone just told me, wrote to me and said that he had written his dissertation on Faulkner's relationship to his brothers and the way that Faulkner's psychology was organized in competition to his brothers. I haven't read the dissertation, and I don't know the details, but I've had this experience over and over again of these putative lone geniuses turning out to have been embedded in fascinating relationships.
I was just reminded of Sal Bellow's Nobel speech when he said, I just started out trying to compete with my brother. I mean, a lot of this does get back to competition. A lot of this gets back to rivalry and just the dyad nature of things. And it also is, a lot of your ideas here are upheld by neuroscience. You're talking about different parts of the brain, aren't you? You're talking about often the creative and the technical working together or...
Sure.
Yeah.
There are neurological foundations of this stuff and this field of social neuroscience, which was a term of mockery when it was first coined in the 1980s, is now a major area of investigation. The idea that the human brain is made what it is through interconnections. And that's certainly true in developmental psychology. And a lot of what that brings us into is stuff that's passionate and messy and uncomfortable, like rivalry and competition. Human relationships are not sort of clean systems that you can organize in a really simple way. And a lot of times they're uncomfortable. And one of the things that I emphasize in the book is that creativity is not the same as happiness. Creativity is not necessarily the same as well-being. A lot of times the things that vex us and arouse us, like the cliche of the oyster and the grain of sand, are the things that produce the most beautiful pearls.
Joshua Wolf Schenk is with us this hour. His book is called Powers of Two, Seeking the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Although sometimes, you know, you've got a greater genius who's disproportionate, who may just be playing off ideas off of someone else. And as you said, sometimes this works, especially in the world of entertainment. Somebody's really the performer as opposed to the introvert who's maybe behind the performer or helping the performer or
sure.
All that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think a creative relationship needs to be equal in terms of credit, in terms of power, not even in terms of talent. The question is, are two people doing something together beyond what they could do on their own? And yet when you do dig into it and you see these cases of dramatic inequality, if you look at South Park, for instance, where, you know, Trey Parker is clearly, you know, this extraordinarily original character who really, you know, in any context would be doing brilliant things. And Matt Stone is his muse and sparring partner and producer and so on. But when you get deep into it, the interconnections are so vast. It's like gears in a clock, and maybe one of the gears seems more primary, but if something else is enabling it and instigating it and supporting it all the way through, you really start to see that the key thing is the larger organism. That's where our focus needs to be.
Well, you mentioned the word muse, and you may be familiar with Francine Prose's book on muses.
Yes.
Very powerful book. I mean, if somebody is inspiring whomever the genius might be, and muses are often identified with men being inspired by women, alas, though we're breaking down those gender lines, I suspect, you're talking about just, you use the word ignition. This is a kind of ignition. What helps to ignite maybe the real genius as opposed to the person who's just inspiring, who's there as a kind of, catalyst, an inspiration.
Well, yes. But then the question becomes, you know, what's primary? Is the thing being catalyzed or the catalyst primary? And I think that we're best served if we draw back and say the important thing is the relationship between those two qualities and trying to ascribe who's doing more, who's doing what. And when you get inside these partnerships, the thing that really characterizes them is a sense of we. When John Lennon and Paul McCartney met, they were teenagers, and they almost immediately agreed that they would co-credit everything they did. It would all be Lennon-McCartney, although at one point, Paul really thought it was going to be McCartney-Lennon, and that's a story I tell in the book, and a very interesting one. There's tension within it, but that sense that the two of us are something bigger and we really can't be taken apart, and you see that over and over again. I talk about it in the book as confluence, this geological metaphor of two rivers flowing into one another and becoming the same body of water.
But there's the disproportionate credit and recognition. I mean, you talk a lot about your relationship with your editor in this book and whose name is on the book and who's doing the book tour and all that. It's not your editor.
Well, it's not necessarily disproportionate credit. It's different kinds of credit. I mean, it's true that I am the public face of the book and I'm doing these things that I love to do, by the way. I love to be on stage. I love to talk about these ideas. I like being represented with this body of work. And Eamon Dolan, who is the co-creator of the book, you know, takes different pleasures. He gets recognized and gets credit in other ways. And if you look at the sort of the star director dynamic, the onstage and offstage dynamic, which is a very common one in the book, oftentimes the person who is on stage is always seeking, always hungry. It's never enough. It doesn't matter how big you get. It doesn't matter, you know, how dramatic your list of prizes are. Whereas the person who takes credit on a human scale actually can be satisfied.
So this can be a lot of, as you point out in your book, a lot of introverts working with extroverts, to use a Jungian designation in terms of personality types.
That yin and yang, introverts, extroverts, I talk about the liquid and the container in my book, the associative type and the type who's better with structure.
You also talk about the dreamer and the doer.
Yes. Yeah. And these things show up over and over again. We're used to thinking about personality types and obsessing about them, but there also are relationship types that show up over and over again. And one of the things that's very useful for I've heard from readers of the book is that they see, oh, wow, okay, I have a language now for something that was such an important part of my life. And I have a language to talk about creative relationships themselves, which are so huge, and yet they kind of exist in the shadows. It's as if we were in a culture that had no vocabulary for love. Well, that would be crazy, because love is such an important part of the way we organize our lives. But in terms of our work lives, it's the same thing for these creative relationships, and yet they've really been obscured and neglected.
Well, and you also talk about the star and the director. So you'd be the star, your editor would be the director, or something along those lines. I think a lot of people can relate to this. Man, I've called my closest friend since boyhood, who's a world-famous geneticist. We've been in a kind of rivalry all these years. We love each other, I think, but, you know, it's been a lot of competition and a lot of seeking in different ways, and also cross-fertilizing in different ways in terms
yes.
of what we've been able to make of our lives.
Oh, well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, no, and it's, I think, something that probably a lot of people can, as I said, and we'll hear from our listeners on this, this kind of synergy or... It's also team power. You know, I sit here behind a microphone, and a lot of people think of me as the program, but I'm looking at Judy Campbell there, Irene Noguchi, and the names you hear at the end of every program.
Sure.
Tina Larberg, Dan Zoll. These are people who have an immense amount to do with just whatever we do and whatever we're able to accomplish and put up in the air every day.
Yes.
Well, this is also alpha and beta, isn't it?
Well, I'm glad to hear you know, refer to what's happening on the other side of the glass. That's hugely on my mind as I do radio interviews. And it gets to an important point, which is the person who is off stage, a lot of times they ought not be a major part of what's presented to the public. And that's okay, because that's actually the way things work well a lot of the time. But when we come then to study creativity, that person who has been offstage in terms of the public presentation oftentimes gets erased. Theo Van Gogh didn't sign the canvases, and that's appropriate. But the problem is that the scholars and the historians have not done a proper job bringing Theo fully into that story. And then we don't have a clear idea of how these works that we so much love were made, and we don't have a clear idea about how creativity happens in the first place.
But you think it's tied to connectivity between people. I think that's pretty clear and present in your thesis here.
I do. I think there's also immense variation in it, and it does not negate solitude. It does not negate the power of individual presence. If anything, connectivity enhances and empowers a kind of individual presence, which then comes back to the relationship, and you have this harmonious cycle.
But there are pairs that you mentioned that are recognizable to most of us. C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, for example. But you mentioned a name with Dave Chappelle. I know Dave Chappelle's work. I don't know the name that you mentioned. Daniel Kahneman, I know his work. I don't know. I know a little bit about Tversky, but, you know, most of us know very little about Tversky. We mainly know the man who's front and center.
That's interesting. Well, yeah, Tversky died quite a while ago.
His daughter was one of our interns, in fact.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Before the major acclaim for their work. But Kahneman is very clear that everything he does grew out of this groundbreaking research with he and Tversky. C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien are a very interesting case because we talked about hidden partners. There's often a case where you have two people who neither of whom is hidden. They are both very well known for distinct bodies of work, and yet they are affecting each other behind the scenes. And that was certainly the case with Lewis and Tolkien.
And you talk about a kind of six-stage process in this. Can you give us kind of a thumbnail of what that is?
Sure. Well, the book is organized around stories. I think the ideas that we come up with to represent experience are just a way of pointing at the truth of stories. And so I looked at how do pairs meet and what happens next and all the way through, and identify these six major themes, starting with electricity itself and chemistry and this love at first sight, creative love at first sight quality, which does happen over and over again.
Can be animus too, though, can't it? I mean, people can thrive on feelings of trying to prove themselves through a rivalry, and there's a lot of ambivalence and even in some cases enmity.
Well, the metaphor of electricity is a great one, because electricity can feel like you're a toy car and suddenly there's a battery in you and you can just zip across the floor, but it could also feel like getting an electric shock. Those are both experiences of electricity that are galvanizing. And it's true, a lot of times when pairs first meet each other, when Larry Page and Sergey Brin first met, they immediately broke into an argument and they were described as two swords sharpening each other. Mm-hmm. Lewis and Tolkien also had they were kind of fighting with each other like bear cubs, one of their friends said. John Lennon and Paul McCartney. There was also this kind of animal electricity when they first met. A friend said that they were like they were circling each other like cats. But there's often a feeling of an enormous expansion and desire and absorption that may feel pleasant.
You write a bit about the Currys, and yet most of these pairs are not married. And I'm wondering how much marriage plays into this whole thesis that you've wrought here for us. I mean, because this is a duality. This is, you know,
yes.
People operating together.
Yes. Some great creative pairs are married. Some great creative pairs are siblings, like the Coen brothers. Some they're fathers and sons, and mothers and daughters. The relationships take all forms. Sometimes creative pairs are actual rivals, not just in the energy, but they're trying to beat each other, like Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, who really created each other and made each other's careers out of this animosity and this intense rivalry. So the form of the relationship, according to our ordinary way of understanding it, is infinite.
It's multiple.
It's meant to, but the core qualities show up over and over and over again, and that's what I was interested in trying to get to in the book.
One of these pairings that a lot of people may simply be unaware of is Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy.
Yeah. Abernathy is mysterious even to King scholars. They were together from the very beginning in the Montgomery bus boycott, and they up literally until King's final moments. He was shot on the balcony of a motel room that was referred to as the King Abernathy Suite because they stayed there together so often. They always shared rooms. They were always alone together, very, very commonly alone together. And one of the things that this presents a real problem for historians, because when the material of the relationship is so private, what is then left for us to parse it afterwards? And it's unclear what happened, a lot of what happened between King and Abernathy, but we know that Abernathy was absolutely indispensable to King. He kept him close. He designated him his successor. They did these public events together. And again, you have a classic onstage, offstage dynamic where Abernathy was not the guy facing the cameras. He was not the guy on the cover of Time magazine, but the relationship was indispensable.
I was also thinking about Martin and Lewis. I mean, you know, they're both out there performing, or they were when they were famous, and then, of course, they came to a split. There's so much to kind of think about with this. When you talk about chemistry and electricity, I think of Amory Bergson's idea of elan vital. There's something, in other words, some kind of vital energy, and it may even be eroticized. In many instances, it is.
That's right. And that's what I'm most curious about, is trying to get to it, and it's still
it's a bit
elusive
amorphous,
to me.
Isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, it's a question that is bigger than any of our answers. But part of the value of this, I think, is bringing the question into our day-to-day experience, which is something that we are not taught to do. We're taught to think about what happens in our head. And maybe if we're in a corporate environment, we're taught to think about teams and networks and so forth. But we're really not taught to think about creative intimacy as a foundation.
Well, let's find out what you, our listeners, have to say about creative intimacy as a foundation, or you may want to talk about positive psychology, which I brought up earlier because of an article our guest Joshua Wolfshank did in The Atlantic. But let's hear from you. Our toll-free number is available to you, so feel free to join the conversation. The number to call is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program. Questions or comments, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Joshua Wolfshank, and he will be appearing, by the way, at the Berkeley Arts and Lectures on September 25th, and then at Books, Inc. in San Francisco on September 26th, but he's here with us now to talk about his latest book, and we're also talking about an article he did. The latest book is called Powers of Two, Seeking the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs, and you may want to weigh in on this subject. Number of ways to join us, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us, our Twitter handle at KQED Forum, or join us by going right to our Facebook page. I also brought up in the first part of the hour an article he did in The Atlantic, which certainly struck a lot of interest in me. And I know many of our listeners are interested in this whole idea of how you find happiness. And this is the most exhaustive study of its kind. It was done at Harvard with 268 men, began in 1938. Under George Valiant, inevitably under George Valiant. You can also join us by phone. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. And let's go to your calls. Let's begin, Camillo, with you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Your guest mentions the Lennon-McCartney relationship, but I was wondering what about the rest of the team, specifically George Martin, their producer, who was the one who was really trained in music notation and arranging and all that stuff, and where would they be without the rest of the team, the rest of the Beatles plus their producer?
That's a great question, and I think the best image to think about the Beatles is a series of concentric circles. My main argument is that all the way at its core, there's not an individual. It's John Lennon and Paul McCartney, and as their engineer Jeff Emmerich said, the artist was Lennon and McCartney. But of course, they existed in a context which was the band, and there was a foursome. And it's true that what George Harrison said, how many Beatles does it take to change a light bulb? Four. And then the band existed in a context. And so that's the next circle out. George Martin, Jeff Emmerich, they had these guys from Liverpool who were always around them as helpers. Brian Epstein was critical. And at the end of the story, after looking at all these phases of chemistry and connection and all the arc of John Lennon and Paul McCartney, I do really get into the context, because it turns out when you want to understand how people endure as a pair or how they falter, that context becomes of critical importance. And the major thing at the end of that story is not the dynamic between John and Paul, which was tumultuous. It was always tumultuous. The main change at the end of the story is what happened to that context. Brian Epstein dying and there being a vacuum there. George Harrison wanting to change his role in the band, and that causing all kinds of difficulty, and that's really what led them to the split.
I thank you for the call. In fact, bringing up George Martin with the Beatles makes me think of Colonel Tom Parker with Elvis, and I always think about these figures who work in this dyad way, but also he took around a lot of his buddies, you know. I mean, there was a kind of a clique that went with Elvis everywhere.
That's
and he
right.
kind of fed off them.
It's also true that there are multiple dyads operating in any one situation. I mean, I tend to focus on one pair at a time. But it's also true that there was a dynamic, a very strong dynamic, between Paul McCartney and George Martin. Paul was sort of the band leader in those sessions, and George was doing all the things the caller alluded to his doing. Quite brilliant, and had a huge role in shaping those very distinct sounds on those albums. There's also dynamic between John Lennon and Brian Epstein, and all of these dynamics were operating. But the point is not any one dyad. The point is to look at the dyad as a model and as a unit of creativity, which we're not used to doing.
Well, I want to go to more of your calls and emails in just a moment, but we left something hanging here, and that was that six-part process that you started talking
yes.
about. Can you take us through that quickly?
Sure. Chemistry, electricity, where does it come from? Once pairs have experienced it, there's a question of how they negotiate a joint identity, and that's the second main stage, which I describe as confluence. Then we have to consider roles and distinct positions within the partnership, and I call that dialectics. Then, and this was a huge surprise to me, you have to look at distance between the pairs. You're used to thinking of once two people are joined, they're like two hands clasped together, but it's actually much more like a dance. They're moving away from each other and coming back together, and some pairs might work best on opposite continents, and some pairs might work best in the room with each other all day long, but there are many variations. Then we have to consider rivalry, competition, conflict, tension, which is at the height of a pair's work, often hugely brought to bear, and is often can tip them into dysfunction, but also is a huge part of the creativity. And then that leads us to the question of how do they endure or how do they falter, and that's the final stage of interruption.
We've been talking a good deal of music. You could almost trace that trajectory of Simon and Garfunkel you just mentioned, but then the split was permanent until they came back together.
Well, very often that's the case, and that's the reason I refer to it as interruption, and many Beatle fans will be surprised to hear me say that I don't think that John Lennon and Paul McCartney did really split in the sense of a final dissolution. I think they were unable to work together at a certain point, but that the energy remained, and that as that story played out, there were a number of chances at reunion that were foiled, and had John Lennon lived, I'm quite confident there would have been a reunion.
But the narrative often pins a lot of the blame, probably unfairly, on Yoko Ono. I mean, somehow the idea, it's like the Garden of Eden, a woman gets involved and then things fall, or whatever, along those lines. That's the narrative.
We want a simple story. We want a, you know, simple beginning, middle, and end. And that's one of the reasons why The Lone Genius keeps showing up, because it's a very convenient narrative unit, but it doesn't fit with reality.
We'll go to more of your calls, and Suzette joins us next. Suzette, hi.
Good morning. I'm really happy to hear this discussion. I just noticed recently that my husband and I, who both have very different academic backgrounds, are influencing each other in ways that we never thought that we could before, and it makes for really great conversation. So I'm a public health consultant, daughter of accountants, and he's an artist, son of architects. And the way that our knowledge around math and things that are spatially put together and the way that things are organized, we find really interesting ways to influence each other, and it makes for an electric feeling, both positive and in negative ways, the way that you were talking about earlier, how sometimes when it works really well, it does, but then our conversations can go off crack course, and then they come back in a really interesting way. And so I'm just happy to hear that there's an academic discussion about this, because I'm only now really seeing that duality play out, and it's really an interesting and beautiful thing.
Okay, we thank you for the call.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I am trying to create a language and a vocabulary for what you're describing, and it is interesting. I've heard from many people that they're creative partnerships operating that they've never identified as such. And it's helpful to name it and to be able to then cultivate it and draw it out and to see its benefits and to see its challenges and to work with it in a way that will further you both.
The listener who writes on Facebook, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, Bill Gates and Paul Allen seem so different from Bill Hewlett and David Packard, who were great friends and equals. Are the younger teams more media geared, where one of the two, Jobs and Gates, being more media appealing and thus better known?
A lot of times one member of a partnership will be, you know, more comfortable in the public role. And a lot of times we then forget about the shyer person who, you know, prefers to burrow into you know, his work. And Wozniak and Jobs is a great example. I mean, that is two people who are extremely dissimilar, and yet the dissimilarity combined with their shared passions is a lot of what fueled that work. And it's very hard to imagine the original Apple computer without that meshing of those two, of their distinct talents and interests.
Let me go to a few more emails before we go to more calls. Paul writes, does your guest discuss the case of Marie and Pierre Curie? Yes, he does. But there is one. Isn't this one of the few cases where the woman's role in fame predominates?
It is, and it's interesting because feminists really seized on Marie Curie as an icon and have diminished Pierre Curie. That this does ordinarily happen to women, and there are many, many cases of women who are totally pushed out of a story. Linus Pauling was drawn into peace activism work by his wife, Alma, and yet when the Nobel Prize Committee awarded him a Nobel Prize, they ignored her. Marcia Lucas and her role in the early Star Wars movies is totally erased from the official history and is barely known even by avid fans of those stories. So I think the broader feminist impulse ought to be to look at relationships in all their manifestations, and not exclude anyone from that story.
Actually, he invited Marcia Lucas once to be interviewed many, many years ago, and one of the strangest turndowns I've ever received.
How so?
It was dramatic. No, absolutely, under no circumstances. I mean, it was like stringing out those kind of, I mean, obviously she didn't want any kind of public light for whatever reason.
Yes.
Here's Tom who writes, you mentioned Lennon-McCartney as an example of a dynamic duo with very different approaches. What about Jagger Richards? Mick Jagger's a jet-setting glamour guy, the man of wealth and taste. Richards is dry-witted and straight-talking. Jagger gets into the showmanship aspect. Richards is focused on the music. Oddly enough, while Lennon-McCartney split up, Jagger and Richards have stayed together despite frequent acrimony. Richards has been quoted many times saying, we met in the sandbox when we were four. I can't divorce him.
Yeah. Have they stayed together as a creative pair, though, is my question. They certainly are together as a business pair and as a performance pair, but I think the Rolling Stones are really like a tribute band to themselves these days. And if you look at the real creativity, which a lot of people think petered out around Exile on Main Street, there was enormous tension and fighting, and it was all, they were able to contain it. Whereas now these guys live very separate lives and they have a kind of business agreement. So I think the arc is very much like John Lennon and Paul McCartney. It just has a different name and a different way of framing it.
There's another call from Palo Alto. Evan, you're on. Good morning.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious what you think about, you've talked a bit about the creative power of pairs of individuals. I'm wondering to what extent you think that kind of synergistic effect applies or doesn't apply to the political sphere between Democrats and Republicans, for example. What is keeping that competitive relationship from really producing something productive?
Yes. Well, the core of relationships is a shared an alignment, a rapport, a sense of shared values alongside attention and friction and even animosity or competition. And so you need to have both those things at the same time. And depending on where you are, just like a guitar string could be flat or could be sharp, you may need to emphasize one or the other. And it's, I think, certainly true in the political process that, you know, where we are in this country, we need to go back to the shared sense of purpose. It's also true that...
Excuse me, look at John McCain and Joe Lieberman. I mean, they have a kind of dyad, it almost seems like a love affair in some ways, and yet from different political party backgrounds, they're able to work together. But up on Capitol Hill, forget it.
I mean, it's also true that this, you know, when you look at the great turning moments of history, a lot of times relationships are at the core in ways that get forgotten. If you think about what Nelson Mandela did, it's true that he was a very special guy, and he had his own partnerships within his movement that were critical, but also the relationship between Mandela and de Klerk, the relationship between Reagan and Gorbachev, these relationships are what history turns on.
There's a listener who writes, from an arithmetical point of view, it would seem that the effort required to make a disruptive difference in any field may be most efficiently reduced with the addition of a first partner. The value of further additions would be logarithmically less and be quickly offset by the reduced focus that groups suffer. This may be reflected most often in the number of lone geniuses that are actually duos of husband and wife, where historical attitudes mask the crucial contribution of the latter. On the other hand, there are endeavors of great complexity that really benefit from concerted action by larger, more closely allied groups.
Yes. The group is a very important unit, obviously. Jazz trio or all the way up to the U.S. Senate. You need to look at the whole group in order to have a honest sense of what's happening, but that is a very a common discussion. The thing that we've hardly ever talked about is the special quality of the pair, which is immensely, it's very unusual because it's immensely fluid and flexible, and it allows two individuals to be individuals and to be a group, to switch roles and to take roles, and it has a power of creativity that is diminished as soon as you have even a third person because things become more structured and solidified, and that can be very valuable, but it's less inherently creative. And even within great groups, a lot of times people will pair off to do the important work, like Monty Python was a troupe, and there's an integrity to the whole group, but they would pair off as dyads to do a lot of the writing.
Let me go back for a moment to Republicans and Democrats and to the article in The Atlantic about the happiness study and George Valiant and so forth, because they were able to predict who would become a Democrat and who would become a Republican?
I don't remember that. That may be the case.
I think that was the case. I was going to ask you, well, we have to go back and read The Atlantic article again as to what that was based on. But I think it just said that they were able to predict on what basis. I was curious. But let me get back to more of our callers who are waiting patiently. Ed, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. I'm wondering about the situation of finding that person that you're dyadic with. I've had a number of people throughout my life But currently I have a person that is has a big gap between my technical ability and his own. However, he has the teaching position and I don't. So I'm an auxiliary many miles away, and it's kind of frustrating because it's like I'll present a piece of scientific material, and he'll have a really long, hard time understanding it. It feels like I'm pulled down by this constantly. However, he is much more real in the world than I am. I kind of think in my little cubicle in Berkeley here, and he's involved in teaching and making things, and much more. I envy his manifestation. So I'm wondering. I don't know. Perhaps if I found another. I love him dearly, but it's very difficult for me to fly the larger ideas that I have. It's impossible.
You haven't resorted to Craigslist yet, or any ads, personal ads, or things like that.
It seems to lose the magic there somehow. I don't. Maybe I should get over that, but. It seems to lose the magic of finding a person in the right place at the right time.
Sort of like finding a mate or a partner, isn't it,
yes.
Josh?
And I think the big thing, in a very small way, is just to learn to pay attention to our experience of chemistry with people around creative questions. And where do we feel a little sharper, a little smarter, a little funnier? And it might be, you know, just a very small moment at any given time. But that out of that seed... are where great connections come from. And even when a lot of things are right on paper, if you feel a little slower or a little deadened by someone, I think that really deserves a lot more attention than we ordinarily give it. These kind of infrastructural, institutional synergies are a lot less potent over time than what emerges organically between two people.
Well, good luck, Ed. You know, right. Seek and ye shall find. At least we have to try to believe that sometimes. Here's Fred, who writes, does the public, fascinating question he raises, does the public unknowingly perpetuate and cause the lone wolf or independent innovator mythos for famous innovators, even in the face of contrary evidence? On a larger scale, do people have a tendency to accept the stories that ignore partnerships and paint innovators as independent and self-reliant? If so, why?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of it comes down to the power of the story of the lone genius. It's a very convenient and dramatic. A lot of it is also about our imagined relationship to these great lone geniuses. We want to think about Einstein breathing his brilliance across a generation into our ears. When we read a book, we don't want to think about the editor. And a lot of times the editors stay disengaged because they're very mindful of that relationship between the reader, that imagined relationship between the reader and the writer. And that is very potent when we're in stage at a rock concert. We're in this kind of imagined relationship with the star on stage. But it's not, it doesn't diminish that connection to look at the way things have been generated.
Well, we wouldn't be reading the Hemingway that we read today were it not for Maxwell Perkins, and that holds true for a number of other writers as well that he was a masterful editor with.
Yes.
But one of the biggest ongoing controversies is about a writer like Raymond Carver, who was
yes.
not only, shall we say, influenced by his editor, but was in some ways dominated by his editor.
Yes, and that power struggle, which you know, broke out into the open when Lish talked a little bit too freely for Carver's taste about what he had done, and is still playing out with Carver's widow having you know brought out these unedited stories. I mean, the pairs work to the extent that they are able to subjugate this craving for individual recognition to a sense of the we. And of course, those two things are always in tension to some extent, but you have to keep it under wraps to some extent for things to work. So when Dave Chappelle and Neil Brennan went into the writer's room to prepare a sketch, they came out and they didn't talk about who had done what. And when something didn't work, they didn't. Neither one said, oh, that was you. They took joint credit and they took responsibility for the things that didn't work. And that is a constant balancing point for effective pairs to be able to maintain that sense of we.
That's often very tough. I mean, there are a lot of human beings who just by nature say, I want credit. You know, this is my idea. And they want the recognition that goes with it.
It's inherently unstable. And the instability is a lot of the power. You know, the story of the Wright brothers making the first flying machine is really beautiful because they had this very tumultuous relationship. They fought fiercely and they seemed to love it, but they were just always going at each other. And they had very different characters. And whether it was intuitive or you know related to this, it's not entirely clear. But their insight for the flying machine is that it would work only to the extent that it was able to adjust to this immensely unstable conditions in the air. And that was very contrary to the dominant idea of the time, which was you just needed to get something very solid and stable into the air and shoot it across the air with as much horsepower as you could get. They said, no, it's not. You need a little bit of an engine, but you just need to be able to adjust here and there and all these different axes. And that's what led to the first airplane.
More of your calls. David, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I am actually in a position where I am dealing with looking at personality types. I just actually was working on that last night, and I was just wondering kind of like, is there an understanding of how partnerships can work with certain combinations of personality types, like through Myers-Briggs or Enneagram, that kind of thing?
Yeah, there's a whole section on the book about the kinds of types that recur over and over again, and I organize them into what I call these three archetypes, the liquid and container, the star, the director, and the dreamer and the doer. And thinking about those kinds of combinations is definitely fundamental.
And again, Joshua Wolf Shank's book is called Powers of Two, Seeking the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Cheryl writes online as a teacher, teaching primarily in one-to-one private lessons for over two decades. It has been that relationship that has created the HARP technique I have developed. I think the student-teacher relationship can be an excellent example of what Mr. Shank is illuminating.
It really can be, and this is one of the things for people think, oh, well, I work alone. Well, it may be that that's the case now, but what about the way that you were influenced or created? If you look at Emerson and Thoreau, Thoreau is famous for his solitude, but really he was formed and shaped by his mentor Emerson, and that doesn't end when Emerson is no longer in his life day to day. That lasts as an imagined relationship, and that's a quality of distance that I explore in the book.
You know the famous story, it may be apocryphal, about when Thoreau was jailed for not paying the poll tax that supported the Spanish-American War, and Emerson went to visit him, and he said, Henry, what are you doing in there? And Thoreau supposedly said, what are you doing out there? Anyway, here's Addie who writes, it's simple. Working with a partner is just way more fun. All my best work is happening in a partnership with someone else. Well, it's not necessarily that simple, but what about the fun side of things?
Yeah, I mean, laughter and just a sense of ease and a sense of, you know, expanded possibility. That's a lot of, you know, where these things begin. And there's a quote in the book that laughter is the shortest distance between two brains. I think that's true. And that often comes hand in hand with other experiences that are not so easy. John Lennon and Paul McCartney had a ton of fun together, and I think they brought each other more joy than any two human beings I can think of. And they also brought each other an enormous amount of pain and difficulty. And that's holding those two things together in our mind allows us to see their story.
Charles raises a question. He's asking about muses, female muses, and the history of female muses who inspired significant works by men. What percentage of these relationships included sex? Now, I'm sure you don't necessarily have the answer to that arithmetically, but some of these relationships, same-sex or heterosexual, do include sex and lovemaking and the like.
Yeah. I'm really interested in eroticism as a quality of creative exchange, and I think it's important to distinguish it from the sex act. Eroticism is not a physical thing. It's a quality of mind and body and a feeling of not of satisfying the yearning, which is what we think of sex as, but of a heightening of that yearning and a sense of the distance and the challenge of another presence. And I think paying attention to that and getting comfortable with that is another really important thing. People think if they're feeling some kind of erotic charge with someone else, well, it has to be sexual. And that's not the case. A lot of times you can feel that and you can, instead of, you know, making love in the traditional way, you can make art.
And here's Bill. Bill, you're on. Good morning.
Well, thanks. I'd like to have Mr. Shank comment on Frank Lloyd Wright. I mean, he does seem to be the lone wolf kind of artist, but, you know, on the other hand, he was essentially nothing without his clients. He needed some sort of inspiration and to get the pencil moving across the paper. And Falling Water, for example, seems to come straight out of his head without any input from anybody, even the client so much, except for the location of where to build a house. And I don't think there was another architect, even today, who would build something like the Guggenheim Museum.
You know, architects are a great case where if we reduce the story to the single individual, Frank Gehry, Zaha Hadid, and every time you look into it more deeply, you see there are critical relationships operating. Yes, of course, they're doing something special. That's why they're known. That's why we pay such attention to them. But architects are a classic case where they're never in the big picture doing it alone.
And we thank Bill for the call. Here's Anita writing us by email. The three primary romantic relationships I've had in my life had creative intricacy at their core. When they have broken up through divorce or breakups, the loss of the creative intimacy was just as painful as the loss of love.
That's powerful.
Another listener, Chris, writes, my brother and I play in a band together. The fact that we know each other so well means that sometimes it feels we can read each other's minds. Our connection with each other is deeper than with anyone else, and I really do think it makes our music special. And it's not only that we get along so well, there's also a tension and competitiveness that continues to always move us forward. Listener writes, curious if this book explores and attributes gender and or social expectations and differences in leadership or rivalry styles. Answer is yes, most affirmatively. Actually, we've come to the end of the hour. Let me, I'm sorry, there are a bunch of other emails here that I don't have time to get to, but you can continue this discussion online simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And Josh Schenck, good to have you with us. Thank you so
much.
Great
to be here. Thanks so much.
Josh Wolf Schenck is the author again of Powers of Two, Seeking the Essence of Innovation and Creative Pairs. He'll be at Berkeley Arts and Lectures on the 25th of September and then at Books, Inc. here in San Francisco on the 26th of September. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi and Tina Larberg. We also had production assistance with Dan being on vacation from Susan Breton and Vinnie Tong and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Howard Gelman, and we get online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.